Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Comes when silence is betrayal, even when pressed by the demands of inner truth. Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak.
Now, I've chosen to preach about the war today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry.
And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. We are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else, for it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. That was a mashup that I cannot take credit for, but an anonymous soul on the internet made mostly selections from Martin Luther King Jr.'s Beyond Vietnam speech. Obviously, today you're probably not working. You might be. It's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And I believe last year I shared the entirety of that speech, which is getting a little more daylight than it has in years past. You know, usually we hear I Have a Dream, which is, you know, I'm not here to hate on I Have a Dream, but there's a lot more kind of radical work in Dr. King's legacy, especially toward the end of his life before his assassination. So I always try to focus on that. On this day, I've also got some stuff to share from the local rally that happened this morning in case you missed it. Just a couple highlights that I thought, things that I considered highlights that I pulled out from our live broadcast this morning to share with you today. Before that, I just want to say kind of on this topic of, you know, the Martin Luther King that you might not hear depending on where you went to school, when you were brought up, the more radical side of this kind of legendary, kind of quasi-mythical, that's the risk of becoming mythical, civil rights figure. I thought that I would share a little bit of a short editorial that Bhaskar Sankara wrote this morning in The Guardian. He's the one of the founding editors of Jacobin magazine, a socialist writer, and he wrote about this kind of forgotten part of the legacy. I'm just going to read a tiny bit of it, but I will put the link to the full piece online. So he says, Martin Luther King Jr. is useful to about everyone nowadays. For President Donald Trump, celebrating King is a chance to tell everyone that he shares his dream of equality, freedom, justice, and peace. For Ram Trucks, it's a chance to, well, sell trucks. This wasn't always the case. In 1983, 15 years after King's death, 22 senators voted against an official holiday honoring him on the third Monday in January. The North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms undertook a 16-day filibuster of the bill, claiming that King's, quote, action-oriented Marxism, end quote, was, quote, not compatible with the concepts of this country. He was joined in his opposition by Senators John McCain, Orrin Hatch, and Chuck Grassley, among others. Can't seem to get rid of some of those pesky guys still to this day. Reagan reluctantly signed the legislation, all the while grumbling that he would have preferred a day similar to Lincoln's birthday, which is not technically a national holiday. So there, again, that op-ed continues. I will share the link. I thought it was funny that, you know, John McCain, Orrin Hatch, and Chuck Grassley all opposed it. Yeah, we could talk about them, but we're not going to. We're going to talk about Martin Luther King Jr. And I didn't realize, as someone who is a little bit younger than that, that it's only been a federal holiday since 1983. And just thinking about really how short that period of time has been. Yeah, so hopefully doing a small part today to help not erase the what I think are the cooler parts of his legacy and share that all with you. So I'm going to, toward the end of the show, I'm going to share the local speeches with you now, but I'm going to share a pretty good chunk of King himself reading Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which personally I remember having to read in school, but it wasn't until rereading it a few years ago that I really keyed in on the later parts of it. And I am seeing these parts shared a lot today in certain circles around the critique of the white moderate. And I think that's just something that, particularly in a place like Spokane, but in a time like now when people are often, you know, calling for unity, I think that white folks specifically should have another listen or another read to that specific peace and think about, what do we mean? When we say unity, do we mean unity around the idea that we're all the most comfortable with, or unity around the thing that really needs to be done that's being led from the most affected? So with that, I'm going to kick you into two of the speeches from today. I think I'll just go back to back. So the first is from Curtis Robinson. He's the president of the local chapter of the NAACP, which, as he'll share with you, turns 100 this year, the Spokane, Washington chapter. Pretty cool. Followed immediately by Steffi Nobles Beans. So those two speeches are what you're going to hear right now.
Spokane! I just want to thank the Martin Luther King Jr. Center, Frida, all of the various partners, the other speakers, the convention center, the multitude of workers, and everyone that had a hand in making this the spectacular event that it is. At the Spokane NAACP, or as the Spokane NAACP president, on behalf of the organization and its many other constituents, we appreciate you and we thank you very, very much. And I'll try and get over being nervous here in just a second. It's a big crowd. Okay, so when I ask you this question, I want you to shout out the answer. Okay, everybody ready? Okay. What year is it? Okay. Louder. What year is it? One more time. What year is it? Yes, it is. Thank God. We made it. And I want to let you know that this is the year of the 100-year birthday of your local Spokane NAACP. And as we wrestled with how to celebrate this, one thing that has been very evident on all of our minds is not only what it took to get here, but the fact that we did not get here alone. That we got here together, and what the NAACP, and what it took the NAACP to get here, but also the fact that what the NAACP stands for. It stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So I don't know about it, the rest of you, but for me, that's inclusive. You know, this is about all of us or none of us. All right, can I get some, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Can I get some affirmation on that? You know, that sums it up. It's for the advancement of all of us. And as many of us, you know, my attitude is that it's all of us or none of us. So when we thought about planning how to honor the lives and legacies of the many people that gave their time, their energies, their emotions, their heart, their spirit to the causes of all of our communities and this great organization, and in the service of those ideals, we have launched implicit bias trainings, partnered in upcoming Why Race Matters workshops and town hall meetings like the one tomorrow at Gonzaga on the bail project called the Presumption of Innocence. And just want to let you know, they're all free and they're all open to the public. But yeah, oh yeah, well, let's clap on that one. I'll take a clap on that. But yeah, 2019, that's right. We made it, and thank God again. And I know many of you, like me, we think 2018. What the heck was that? When we think of the shifting and the uprising of women in elected seats of legislation, we also thank God. And yep, off my notes again. And I think of, as I started in last year, you know, that when I think if Dr. King and many of the other great patriarchs of our civil rights era were alive right now, one thing they'd also be saying or thinking is, what took us so long? And yes, it's been a long road. And yes, we still have a long ways to go. Here again, as I said last year, I believe that the great Dr. King would encourage us. He would encourage us to be steadfast, to be tenacious, to be brave, to seek courageous perspectives, restorative mindsets, brave places, and praise spaces. Instead of sacrificing all those principles that we hold dear for the illusion of comfort and safety. Because if we have learned anything in these last couple of years, and I'm just going to be real about it, we are not safe. And the only way we can be comfortable is by distancing ourselves so far from reality that the inevitable human disconnect gets so embedded in us that we end up more shadows of our true selves, becoming potentially worse of the type of human beings and knows we have suffered under. He would probably remind us that we need to be human beings, not human havings. But yet, nonetheless, let us celebrate. Let us celebrate the life and legacy of the great doctor and the many others like him on this day. And in every day, as I heard it said before, every day that we benefit from the opportunities that they have given us. Let us do this by championing the causes that they gave their lives for. Let us do so in such a manner that when everything shifts, as it must and it will, that the hope and the opportunity given us will bear such a mighty fruit that it will launch our collective humanity to an unforeseen healthiness in such a complete fashion that in these dark issues of our past and the atrocities that have been committed and, yes, still happen, that they will never, ever, ever stand a chance of manifesting again. And as we know what he said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. But let us come to that place to where it's not a threat anymore. Let us honor the great Dr. King in that way. Let us honor the Most High in that way. Let us honor each other that way. Let us honor the Most High, the HaMashiach, the Christ. Yes, let us celebrate, but not celebrate my way, not celebrate your way, but let's celebrate in the way, Yahweh, that way. Okay? That's all I got. That's all I can get off of you. Love you guys, man.
Okay. Good morning, Spokane. Good morning. Thank you for coming out to help us celebrate this awesome holiday, the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. First, he was the minister. Then he was the messenger. And then he was a man who impacted the world. We thank you for coming out to stand together in unity with us this morning. As a young woman growing up in the civil rights movement, I am reminded to never forget the dream of a man who was destined for greatness, and those who supported him, loved him, and believed in his dream of making this world a better place. He refused to back down. He marched, and those that were not united with him simply saying, I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm headed up the King's Highway. Today, refuse to turn around. Today, be united, because there were hundreds and thousands and millions who marched, and they did it together. His dream still lives on in you and me, And yet there is still so much more work to be done. Dr. King said that everybody can be great because everybody can serve. He said life's most urgent and persistent question is this: what are you doing for others? How are we serving together to make a difference in our community? Serving together to make sure that everyone has the same opportunities as everyone else. Serving together to make an impact in the earth right here in our community. And we can do it if we are unified. Dr. King would have been 90 years old this month. And I want us to remember to celebrate the dream in unity. I heard a great message on yesterday. And my brother simply said, keep moving toward the other. He said it was more important to be a neighbor than to be defined as a neighbor. You see, you are my neighbor. I am your neighbor. And together we can change our neighborhood. I heard we can speak the same message and yet have many different voices. Spokane, let us come together in unity. I leave you with 5 points of unity. You understand this, that the dream was not only what he dreamed of, but the dream that we still hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. Come together, Spokane, treating everyone with dignity and respect. Celebrating others' cultures and ethnicity and heritage. Understand that during the civil rights movement, people came together. It wasn't a black thing. It wasn't a white thing, a Jew thing. It was a kingdom thing. A nation of people who believed in unity. And never forget this. Dr. King said that we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters or perish together as fools. We must learn to live together, talk together, walk together, today and together in unity. I invest in our young people. They are the future. We must invest in their education, making sure that each and every one of them has the same equal playing field to be successful and thriving leaders. They are the leaders and the dreamers of our country. They are the leaders of tomorrow. We cannot afford to let them down, for we have found that justice plus equality does equal achievement. We want our youth of today and tomorrow to be successful. Tea time. Dr. King said this, the time is always right to do what is right. Spokane, let's come together and do what is right by our fellow man. If you were waiting for the right time, that time is now. Now is the time to come together in unity. Now is the time to come together in harmony and on one accord. Now is the time to love your fellow man. There is power in numbers. There is power in numbers. There is power in unity. And finally, why? You and I can come together to make a difference in our community. We may have differences. We may not always agree. But if we come together, you and I can make an impact in the lives of others. You and I can help to be the change that Spokane needs to see. Let us come together. Strive together, Spokane. Let us do what is right. Let us come together so that we can truly say, we have overcome. We have overcome. We have overcome today. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe that we have overcome today. bless you, Spokane. God bless you.
All right. So if you're just joining us, that was Steffi Nobles Beans, and before her, Curtis Robinson at today's local Spokane Martin Luther King Day March this morning. So if you missed it, there's a little snip. We also broadcast a lot of it live this morning. So thanks to everybody who got that. And yeah, as I said, you're listening to Praxis. If you're just tuning in and you missed the beginning of the show, you can catch the podcast tonight. You can go to kyrs.org. Go to Programs, Praxis, and find the link to the podcast there. You can also look up Praxis on iTunes, Google Play, all of the other places, or go directly to soundcloud.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. And as promised at the top of the hour, I'm going to share just about half of Letter from Birmingham Jail, because I realized I needed a revisitation of it when I saw this quote, these quotes about the white moderate floating around. And I think it's more relevant than it ever was. It's still relevant, unfortunately. So I thought I would share that with you today. So we'll dive right in. Hopefully it won't start too mid-sentence. I tried to pinpoint where we needed to start. So enjoy, and I'll pop back in at the end with a little more info for all of you listeners. Thanks.
Structured. Sometimes the law is just on its face and unjust in its application. I hope you are able to see the distinction I am trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationist. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust, and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice, is in reality expressing the highest respect for law. Of course, that is nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience. It was evidenced sublimely in the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to obey the laws of Nebuchadnezzar on the ground that a higher moral law was at stake. It was practiced superbly by the early Christians, who were willing to face hungry lions and the excruciating pain of chopping blocks rather than submit to certain unjust laws of the Roman Empire. To a degree, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience. In our own nation, the Boston Tea Party represented a massive act of civil disobedience. We should never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was legal, and everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was illegal. It was illegal to aid and comfort a Jew in Hitler's Germany. Even so, I am sure that had I lived in Germany at the time, I would have aided and comforted my Jewish brothers. If today I lived in a communist country where certain principles dear to the Christian faith are suppressed, I would openly advocate disobeying that country's anti-religious laws. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you and the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises a Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice, and that when they fail in this purpose, they become the dangerously structured dams that block the flow to social progress. I had hoped that white moderates would understand that the present tension in the South is a necessary phase of the transition from an obnoxious negative peace in which the Negro passively accepted his unjust plight to a substantive and positive peace in which all men will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. Actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with. Like a boil that can never be cured so long as it is covered up, but must be open with all its ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light, injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. In your statement, you assert that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But is this a logical assertion? Isn't this like condemning a robbed man because his possession of money precipitated the evil act of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical inquiries precipitated the act by the misguided populace in which they made him drink hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never-ceasing devotion to God's will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see that as the federal courts have consistently affirmed, it is wrong to urge an individual to cease his efforts to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest may precipitate violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. I had also hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth concerning time in relation to the struggle for freedom. More and more, I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than have the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively in the knowledge that the time is always ripe to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy and transform our pending national elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of human dignity. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme. At first, I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my nonviolent efforts as though, and it comes perilously. One is a force of complacency made up in part of Negroes who, as a result of long years of oppression, are so drained of self-respect and a sense of somebodiness that they have adjusted to segregation, and in part of a few middle-class Negroes who, because of a degree of academic and economic security, and because in some ways they profit by segregation, have become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in the various black nationalist groups that are springing up across the nation, nourished by the Negro's frustration over the continued existence of racial discrimination. This movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America, who have absolutely repudiated Christianity, and who have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. I have tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalists, for that is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I am grateful to God that through the influence of the Negro Church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now the hatred and despair of the black nationalists, for that is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I am grateful to God that through the influence of the Negro Church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now many streets of the South would, I am convinced, be flowing with blood. And I am further convinced that if our white brothers dismiss as rabble-rousers and outside agitators those of us who employ nonviolent direct action, and if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, millions of Negroes will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain depressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Consciously, unconsciously, he has been caught up by the spirit of the times, and with his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. If one recognizes this vital urge that has engulfed the Negro community, one should readily understand why public demonstrations are taking place. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations, and he must release them. So let him march. Let him make prayer pilgrimages to the city hall. Let him go on freedom rides and try to understand why he must do so. If his repressed emotions are not released in nonviolent ways, they will seek expression through violence. This is not a threat, but a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like a mighty stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus Christ. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. Was not John Bunyan an extremist? I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below that environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. I had hoped that the white moderate would see this need. Perhaps I was too optimistic. Perhaps I expected too much. I suppose I should have realized that few members of the oppressor race can understand the deep groans and passionate yearnings of the oppressed race, and still fewer have the vision to see that injustice must be rooted out by strong, persistent, and determined action. Let me take note of my other major disappointment. I have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. Of course, there are some notable exceptions, and I am not unmindful of these. But despite these notable exceptions, I must honestly reiterate that I have been disappointed with the church. I do not say this as one of those negative critics who can always find something wrong with the church. I say this as a minister of the gospel who loves the church, who was nurtured in its bosom, who has been sustained by its spiritual blessings, and who will remain true to it as long as the cords of life shall lengthen. When I was suddenly catapulted into the leadership of the bus protest in Montgomery, Alabama a few years ago, I felt we would be supported by the white church. But this never came through. All too many ministers found themselves more cautious than courageous and remained silent behind the safe security of stained glass windows. In spite of my shattered dreams, I came to Birmingham with the hope that the white religious leadership of this community would see the justice of our cause and with deep moral concern would serve as a channel through which our just grievances could reach the power structure. I had hoped that each of you would understand, but again, I have been disappointed. I have heard numerous Southern religious leaders admonish their worshipers to comply with a desegregation decision because it is the law. But I have longed to hear white ministers declare, follow this decree because integration is morally right and because the Negro is your brother. In the midst of blatant injustices inflicted upon the Negro, I have watched white churchmen stand on the sideline and mouth pious irrelevances and sanctimonious trivialities. In the midst of a mighty struggle to rid our nation of racial and economic injustice, I have heard many ministers say those are social issues with which the gospel has no concern. I have traveled the length and breadth of Alabama, Mississippi, and all the other southern states on sweltering summer days and crisp autumn mornings. I have looked at the South's beautiful churches with their lofty spires pointing heavenward. I have beheld the impressive outlines of her massive religious education buildings. Over and over, I have found myself asking, what kind of people worship here? Who is their God? Where were their voices when the lips of Governor Bonnet dripped with words of interposition and nullification? Where were they when Governor Wallace gave a clarion call for defiance and hatred? Where were their voices of support when bruised and weary Negro men and women decided to rise from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? Yes, these questions are still in my mind. In deep disappointment, I have wept over the laxity of the church, but be assured that my tears have been tears of love. There can be no disappointment where there is not deep love. Yes, I love the church. How could I do otherwise? I am in the rather unique position of being the son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of preachers. Yes, I see the church as the body of Christ, but oh, how we have blemished and scarred that body through social neglect and through fear of being nonconformist. There was a time when the church was very powerful, and the time when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believe. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was a thermostat to transform the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on in the conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called by God to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authentic ring and forfeit the loyalty of millions and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century.
All right, I'm going to have to cut it short there, just a few minutes before. Again, if you're just joining me at the end of the hour, you've been listening to Praxis here on KYRS. It's Martin Luther King Day. I'm sharing some forgotten-ish and maybe just need to be revisited speeches and words of his. And earlier in the hour, shared some of the speeches from today's rally here in Spokane. That last bit was from a letter from Birmingham Jail, and I wanted to kick it off with the part where he's talking about the role of the white moderate, and then at the end there, as you heard, talking about the role of the church in kind of with both of those groups tending to stifle social movements, to put it kindly, I suppose. And you know, I think there's a lot that's changed since the writing of that letter. I think a lot changed for him as an individual between the writing of that letter and his death, based on the trajectory that you can kind of follow. But it's always, it's good to know where we've been and where we're going. So, I would also just want to share before the end, that it's a really good day to, I mean, every day is a good day to do this, but, to do something tangible, I think, whether it's coming to the march or, but something that will last longer than that. So, particularly, I think if you are a white person, particularly somewhere like Spokane, but anywhere in this country, it's a really good day to give some money if you can, give some time to causes, organizations, individuals that will directly impact positively the lives of people of color in your community. I just made a donation earlier today to the Carl Maxey Center, which you heard Sandy Williams talk about last week. If you listen to the show, there's all kinds of direct causes to support. And, you know, a quick 20-minute online search would reveal all of them to you, and you could choose what's most important to you. There's such a wide variety of things going on. If you would rather support individuals, I know there's a couple of different activists, Rachel Cargi being one. She's an anti-racism educator, and she started a fund for Black women and girls to receive free, like, counseling and therapy, and she raised a ton of money for that, very transparently, and distributes it that way. So whether there's a formal organization you want to support or just individuals through a campaign like that, it's a really great day to do that. So again, if you missed any part of the beginning of the show and you want to catch it, you can listen to the podcast either by going directly to soundcloud.com/praxisradio, PRAXISRADIO, or going to kyrs.org, finding programs, clicking Praxis. So I will be back next week with another live show. And until then, have a good night. I was one by the river in a little tent, oh, just like